MacCast, Sunday, August 26th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Got a good show for you today, I think. We're going to get into a bunch of stuff, including all the latest iPad, iPhone announcement rumors, a little more details about what we might see at those events, how they're going to all shake out. And I think I've already just given away a little bit by saying events. That should give you a little precursor as to what we'll be talking about in the news today. Also, an update to Mountain Lion was released. We'll get into all the nitty and gritty and details there. And then we've got some feedback and comments from you, a little bit of follow-up on some of the last episodes of the MacCast. I got a cool little trick or tip about Time Machine local snapshots. Do you know what those are? Well, you will after this episode, and even more stuff to get into. But before we get to all of that, let me take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Circus Ponies. Now, normally I'm talking to you about Notebook, which is a great application. You should certainly check it out. But as I alluded to last time, Circus Ponies made a big announcement this past week. They just released a new application that is a lot of fun. It brings some nostalgia back for those of us who've been using Macs for a long time, and it has to do with the trash can. They came out with something called iTrash, and it offers a couple of advantages over the built-in trash that's in Mac OS X. One of them being something that happened when Apple moved the trash can to the dock is you lost the ability to have that sort of muscle memory. If you're a mouser like I am, someone who likes to use the mouse, it was always nice to know that the trash can was just down there in the lower right-hand corner. And yeah, you can have it down there in your dock, and it's kind of over to the right side. But as your dock contracts and expands as you open up applications, that icon moves around at the end of the dock. So it's not always in the exact same position. So you get that functionality back. But not just that, they kind of made it fun too, because they have only over 20 characters and animations that you can pick for your trash can. So it doesn't have to be just a plain old generic boring trash can, although they do have the standard OS X trash can icon. They've added additional designs along with animations, so when you throw stuff in the trash, something happens when it's just sitting down there. It's not just static, it can actually be providing a little bit of entertainment. You can choose to have it always on top or have it hidden behind windows, so it gives you some additional options. Also, sounds are there. And anybody who remembers OS 8 and OS 9 days, OS 7, all the way back in the early days of the Mac, we had these great little utilities that would let us customize our trash cans and add sounds and animations and stuff like that. So they're bringing some of that whimsy and that functionality back, and I think that's really cool. But it's not just all fun and games either. There's actually a lot of good functionality in there too, because they expose and give you easy ways to do things like securely empty the trash, force emptying the trash. How many times have you had it where just something wouldn't delete and you were absolutely sure you wanted to delete it, and you have to go in and maybe do a terminal command line thing? You don't need to do that. It's right there. You just right-click, control-click on the iTrash icon, and you've got the commands right there. They also give you the ability to quickly and easily access and eject mounted volumes and stuff like that. So I think it's a cool piece of software. I think it's fun. I think it's useful. And it's at a great price. It's just $4.95. If you head over to circusponies.com, you can check it out. They have all the information there, and buy the software. It's really neat. And big thank you to Circus Ponies for their support of the MacCast. So I'm almost sorry to do this, but I'm going to start off the news today with a bit of a downer story, I think it is, or a frustrating story for a lot of us who are on AT&T and use our iPhones, because a feature that many of us have been wanting and that we found out that iOS 6 is bringing is the ability to do FaceTime calls over cellular. And that's coming in iOS 6, but AT&T came out and said, yes, we're going to support and enable the feature, but you're going to be required to have one of our new shared data plans. So only customers who sign up for what are generally the more expensive shared data plans are going to be able to use the FaceTime over 3G feature, at least on AT&T. I think Verizon is going to allow it across their network. I think Sprint probably will as well. Sprint doesn't really ever restrict anything. But, you know, that's just... Is it just what we've come to expect from AT&T is just not being cool? Consumer groups are really up in arms over this. They're actually claiming that the policy runs afoul of net neutrality laws. But then AT&T came out with kind of almost in a very smug manner and said, you know, that claims that they're going against net neutrality are completely false. The reason being is that FaceTime is built into the device when it ships, and so they have the right to limit and restrict it. It's not add-on software or something that's not added after the fact. And in a lot of ways, they're using the same old classic defense of this decision that they always use, which is, you know, we're trying to eliminate or slow down or restrict the quote-unquote, and they didn't say this, I'm saying this, what they call the data hogs or the high, I think they refer to them as high data usage users. I can't remember the exact terminology that they use. But in essence, what they're saying is that we have to protect the other people on our network from those people who are using applications and devices in a way that are going to use more bandwidth and will, you know, basically go ahead and charge those customers a premium to use these services. And, you know, to me, with the data caps and the restrictions and the limits, you know, if you're going to be making a lot of FaceTime calls, you're going to run afoul and run up against those data limits and then probably want to move to a higher tiered plan anyway, giving AT&T more money so they can charge you more money when you need more bandwidth. But this idea that for the same kind of bandwidth, they're going to, or the same amounts of bandwidth, they're going to charge you more, just seems to be becoming the modus operandi of AT&T, and it's extremely frustrating. And another one of those reasons why I'm seriously considering and looking into buying an unlocked device for my next iPhone, even though it's going to be a huge hit out of pocket up front, just the ability and flexibility to use a pay-as-you-go plan, something like Straight Talk that I've played around with and works remarkably well. The only bummer there is they don't have support for MMS or visual voicemail, but I'm starting to think that I could probably live without those things. Or, you know, move to Verizon. And, you know, I left Verizon for AT&T because of some bad experiences. I don't know if I'm ready to go back yet, but if AT&T keeps pushing forth these really restrictive policies and kind of behaving the way that they do, I think it may be time to move on. And it'd be funny for me to do it over FaceTime because, I just don't even use FaceTime that much. And that's the other thing about this, is it just makes AT&T look bad. And I think the impact on their network is really going to be minimal because I don't think there's a ton of people using FaceTime yet. But maybe once it's on 3G, more people would use it, and that's where their concern lies. I don't know. It seems unfounded. And a lot of us, I think, are just getting fed up with the nickel and diming and constant charges and constant restrictions. But this is what cell phone companies have always done and what Apple's always tried to fight against with the iPhone. Remember, that's why they had the unlimited plans when they first launched the iPhone. It was sort of that dig, and AT&T's even come back after the fact and said that was the worst decision they ever made. Well, of course it was the worst decision they ever made because now they couldn't nickel and dime people, but they found a way back into that, didn't they? Do I sound jaded and frustrated? I think it's because I am. I told you, I didn't want to start off with a downer story. Let's talk about something a little bit more fun. iPhone launch event. It's looking imminent that it's going to be in September. The rumors are we'll have an announcement around September 12th. Those have been confirmed by multiple sources, so I think that's going to be the date for Apple doing a special event. As far as when we'll actually be able to run into a store and buy an iPhone 5, it's really looking like September 21st is going to be the date. Both AT&T and Verizon now appear to have employee vacation blackouts from September 21st through the 30th, so it's definitely going to be sometime in that time frame. We're hearing rumors that they're going to secret training to get ready for the launch event. So, and once again, that's being confirmed by multiple sources. So I think it's very likely that that is going to be the date. So if you've been saving up, getting ready for that announcement, that's when you're going to need to be prepared. As far as the features that we're going to see in the iPhone 5, just a recap, a summary. Most people are believing that it's going to have LTE. Very likely enabled by some new chips from Qualcomm. Obviously, one of the concerns has always been power usage and battery life, also more global frequencies. These new chips are supposed to be more power efficient, have support for more frequencies. So Apple can do a single phone across multiple networks globally. I don't know if it'll hit all of the networks, especially with 4G, but hopefully it will hit most of them. As far as the processor goes, no one's really quite 100% sure. Again, it's going to kind of come down to energy efficiency versus performance. The A5X that is in the new iPad, the dual-core A5, looks like a very likely candidate. It's something Apple already has in the pipeline and is working with, so it would be easy to use that chipset. But there have been rumors that Apple may go with a new quad-core A6 processor to compete with some of the newer Android phones and other phones that are coming out on the market that are featuring quad-core processors. But Apple's done some things with GPUs to kind of make up for the performance, also tweaking the OS because they can kind of control the whole ball of wax. They can really optimize the operating system for the processor so they can eke a lot more performance out of those cores. They might not need a quad-core to kind of get the same kind of benchmark numbers that other smartphones would have with more cores. Screen, it's pretty much confirmed at this point. Apple's going with the taller 4-inch screen, 1136 by 640 pixels. It's going to be still a Retina, more in the 16 by 9, or I think that even actually works out to an exact 16 by 9 aspect ratio, so that's going to be great for watching movies on the device, and they will be using that in-cell touch technology. That's the thing that is going to allow them to put the touch layers and the LCD layers on the same panel. That will allow them to have a slightly thinner design, thinner phone, maybe make a little more room for a bit more battery, which will help support things like the LTE. It's pretty much believed at this point, too, that they're going to have the new dock connector. They're calling it the micro dock connector. There seems to be some discrepancy on the number of pins. We're hearing reports anywhere from 8 pins to 19 pins, depending upon who you ask. And it also depends on whether or not they're using one or both sides of the connector for the pins. If they can get away with one side, it's looking like it might be an orientation-free connector, which would be nice, meaning that you wouldn't have to worry about which side was up when you dock it in. You just insert the connector and away you go. The headphone jack is looking like it's going to be on the bottom, which could be annoying for some users. I don't know that it would be a problem for me. I don't dock my, I don't plug headphones into my iPhone all too often. I don't think it would really be bothersome. And plus, I think with Bluetooth 4, I'm assuming, being in there, which is the lower power version of Bluetooth, and a good set of Bluetooth headphones, you might not even want cables at all. I think that's the way most things are heading, so that might be an option. Camera, haven't heard much about a new camera being in the next generation iPhone. Apple's always had really good cameras in the iPhone. The current camera gets rave reviews, so there might not be any incentive or reason for them to upgrade. Maybe we'll see them jump the megapixels a little bit or go with a little bit larger sensor for a little bit better image quality, but we haven't really heard any rumors to that end. The other thing that had been rumored for a long time was that Apple was going to go with this new nano SIM, much, much smaller SIM. They actually helped push through the specification in the EU. I think it's called the 4FF nano SIM standard. So you'd think that Apple really would like to use it in a new design, but a lot of the leaked images that we'd seen recently showed the design having the more standard micro SIM. So I'm kind of 50-50 on whether or not Apple will have a nano SIM in the next generation iPhone. And then again, on the battery front, what we saw from the leaked images was a battery that was not a lot bigger than the current iPhone 4S battery. That's a little bit concerning, especially given the fact that Apple might put LTE, or is probably definitely going to put 4G LTE support into the new iPhone. They're going to want to keep battery life at least the same as the current generation device, if not improve it. So you're hoping that maybe some of the other design decisions, the new LCD and the chips that they choose, might use up less power, so they'll be able to eke out about the same amount of battery life. We'll have to see on that front, but definitely a concern if they don't really up the capacity of the battery. And the design, I still absolutely hate the two-tone back design where it looks like most of it is a metal face with the little bottom portion and top portion being either glass or plastic. I guess ultimately that's going to be good for dropping, for protecting from breakage. There's going to be less glass to break, but it just looks really odd. I guess I'm going to have to see it in person before I make a final judgment, but it's really looking like that is the design that Apple's going to go with, given all of the rumors and corroboration of that design that we've seen. So that's the summary of the iPhone 5 launch, and it's looking like that launch is going to be just the iPhone 5, maybe iOS 6, well, definitely iOS 6 along with it, and that's it. We had been hearing rumors that, you know, the iPad mini is coming out around the same time frame. It was originally thought that that would be a big announcement, but this past week there seems to be a lot of evidence supporting the fact that Apple's going to do two events just a few weeks apart. The Loop and Daring Fireball were coming up pretty strong this week. John Gruber posted a thing on his blog saying that he was thinking the first or second week of October, Apple would have a second announcement to release the iPad mini along with probably some new iPod designs, iPod Nano, maybe an iPod Touch. And Jim Dalrymple over at The Loop agreed. And then following up later, All Things D also confirmed an October iPad mini event. So it's looking like we're going to get two events right in a row. It's going to be a nice couple weeks to be an Apple fan, I think. As far as what the iPad mini event is going to entail, the 7.85-inch iPad mini, and it's sounding like that's likely to be the final name. John Gruber had thrown out the name, I think, iPad Air, which I don't know if I like that as much as iPad mini, although considering Apple's significant sort of branding behind that Air brand, they may want to leverage that, and it makes it, I guess, sound a little bit higher end. iPad mini makes it feel like more like the iPod mini or maybe more in the iPod Touch range, which actually might be more in line with how they'll try and market it, I think. You know, it's sort of, I don't know, I'm debating on this one. I'm even having the debate with myself as I'm talking to you. You know, I'm saying that, and then in the same breath, I'm thinking, oh, they might want to get away from the, you know, the press and the people saying, oh, it's just a big iPod Touch. Are we going to get back into that rumor, or has the iPad established itself enough as a tablet to avoid that argument, you know, as a different device from the iPod Touch, excuse me. Now, I'm going to go with iPad mini. I think that's what they're going with. So the iPad mini, we did see some new potential case leaks, this third-party case leaks this week. And interestingly, they showed a hole for a rear camera, which I think is going to be cool, likely to have a rear camera on it, although a lot of the competitive tablets have foregone the camera to cut down on price a little bit, I think, and get more in that $200 range. We'd been hearing rumors that the iPad mini will be somewhere in the $200 to $250 range, and if Apple releases it at that price point, I think all bets are off. It's going to crush the market at that price point, and Apple seems to be ramping up production from what we're hearing to something about getting to the point where they can produce 4 million units a week. So it's going to be really high demand, a really big push to get these things out the door, especially at that low price point. There was also in these case designs, though, this small hole in the top center of the unit, which is likely for an external facing mic. So when you're shooting video, you can pick up a little bit better audio. Interestingly, some of the iPhone 5 designs that we've seen also show this kind of second small mic hole. In the case of the iPhone 5, it seems to be between the camera lens and the LED flash. But once again, it's believed that that would be a mic on the back of the device for picking up some better sound, maybe even doing some noise cancellation kind of stuff. So that's kind of the update on the iPad mini. Mac Takahara also seems to think that we'll see a new iPod Nano at that event, and that the big news for the iPod Nano would be getting Wi-Fi support. So having built-in Wi-Fi, which would mean a lot of things. It would mean that it could support iCloud, it could support AirPlay technology, and could also work with Music Match, which I think would be a big boon for that service and a big advantage for the smaller iPod. So that would be cool if that was added. Early rumors as far as the design for a next generation iPod Nano seem to show it returning to a taller kind of form factor, adding a little bit larger screen, and possibly even adding a physical home button. So it's starting to look much more like an iPod Touch or iPhone, which is interesting. You know, obviously a lot smaller because it's that nano size, but that elongated design that we saw for a couple generations of the nano. And then it's also believed we might get a new iPod Touch at that, taking some of the design cues from the new iPhone that would be announced at the event a few weeks earlier. Mainly what it's looking like is that it would get the taller 16:9 screen. I would assume it would also get the in-cell technology, retina display probably. And then also we're seeing some indications that Apple may be adding an LED flash to the camera. And at least one leaked case design for a new iPod Touch shows this odd hole cut out in the lower corner of the back case. So sort of opposite where the camera lens would be, down on the bottom. And the thought is that maybe Apple is going to significantly increase the quality and sound of the built-in speaker for the iPod Touch, giving you a little more bass response, a little bit better sound, which is something you definitely want in an iPod. So it'll be cool to see if that happens. Although that big hole in the back of the case does look a little bit odd. It'll be interesting to see how Apple builds that into the design. But needless to say, we're probably going to get a second, more music-focused, iPad mini-focused event in October. So it should be a good fall for us Apple fans. And in case you didn't notice, the noise surrounding an Apple-branded TV has kind of really died down. For a long time, we were getting a lot of rumors that Apple was getting ready to produce their own television set. This week, I think most of those rumors were put to rest with some statements that were made or some responses to some questioning that were made by Eddie Q, Apple's Senior Vice President of Internet and Software Services. He was basically asked about the likelihood of Apple entering that market, and he reiterated that Apple only enters markets where they think they can create a significant impact and improve a customer experience or address a key problem that a product or a service has. And when looking at the television market, basically there's kind of two things going on, right? There's the whole user experience, how you use the television, how you interact with the hardware. And then there's also the content side of things, how you access content, how you consume that content and stuff like that. And it sounds like Apple really feels they could make a significant impact on the UI side. I would assume also the hardware side. They could, you know, bring their design touch to a new television, but really focusing on the interaction, how you access content on the TV itself. But the problem comes into play, at least according to Eddie's statements, that the content is something that Apple really can't get access to. And the reason being is they can't break the forced bundling that you have with paid TV content, because it's almost impossible for them to acquire the content rights that they need when they're not pushing forth a traditional broadcast model. And Apple's obviously not in broadcasting. They're not a cable company. I don't think they want to become a cable company. And just working within that environment seems like it's an impossible task for them. So it doesn't sound like they even want to tackle it until they can figure out the content side of things. And that's why I've always had this belief, or for a while had this belief, that Apple really plans to disrupt that model in some way. And I think iTunes is a key to that. I think some of the things that they're doing with self-published content is a key to that. But that's going to take time. It's not going to happen anytime soon. It's going to be a slow, arduous process as technology makes those sorts of things possible, as bandwidth becomes available. But eventually, Apple is going to get there, and we're going to break away from these old models that the television and broadcast industry have, and even the movie industry in terms of distribution and stuff like that. And consumers are going to be going more direct, or producers are going to be going more direct to consumers. And I think Apple is going to be strategically positioned in a way to make that really viable and make that happen, along with a few key other companies. I think Netflix is in there. I think Amazon is in there. Potentially Google's in there. So they're all getting ready. But the problem is the media companies, the cable companies just aren't ready to let go of those old models. And until they do that, I really don't think Apple's going to make a move into the space. I think they're going to be happy to keep their TV stuff a hobby, to continue to do the stuff that they have. And if you want to see an example of what I'm talking about, look at the content that has been added to the Apple TV. And it's a lot of that sports content, right? It's MLB, it's NHL, it's NBA. those guys are producing their own content and they're distributing it directly on their own, right? They're doing the deals with cable companies, but they're also doing the deals directly with Apple to get that content out there. Hulu is another quasi-example of that, I guess, and Netflix, all these companies that are built for this new distribution model of using the internet and using these other devices and apps to get their content to the consumers. And Apple will be certainly ready and on the forefront of that when the time comes. But I wouldn't hold your breath for an Apple branded television set. Just get a really cool HD TV and buy the $99 Apple box to tide you over until that day comes around. Apple has already released its first update for Mountain Lion. Mountain Lion 10.8.1 update was released this past week. According to Apple, the update resolves an issue that could cause Migration Assistant to unexpectedly quit, improves compatibility when connecting to a Microsoft Exchange server in Mail. I've actually had a couple of people report to me that Mountain Lion was giving them some issues in situations where they were connecting Mail to Microsoft Exchange servers, so I hope those issues are resolved with this update. Also addresses an issue when playing audio through a Thunderbolt display, resolves an issue that could prevent iMessages from being sent, addressed an issue where the system could become unresponsive when using the pinion input, resolves an issue when connecting to SMB servers with long names, addresses an issue that could prevent Safari from launching when using proxy automatic configuration pack files, and also improves 802.1x authentication with Active Directory credentials. So a number of the updates and issues seem to be in place to resolve some of the cross-compatibility issues with Windows, I had mentioned that the Mountain Lion upgrades had gone pretty smoothly for most consumers. I was getting reports from mostly from business users who were in mixed environments that Mountain Lion was breaking some of the compatibility that they had enjoyed under Lion. So it's good to see Apple addressing those issues. The update was delivered through the App Store's update feature, so that was nice to see. It went very smoothly for me, as well as others I've talked to about it. It was also very small. In my case, I think around 20 megabytes, somewhere in that range, maybe 16. The official release up on Apple's website says it's 24 megabytes, still incredibly small, quick to download, quick to install. And interestingly, you can also get it from Apple's support site directly still. So you don't have to get it just exclusively through the App Store update, although I think that is the easiest way to get it. They didn't mention specifically addressing some of the notebook battery issues that had been reported. A number of people, myself included, noticed that battery life seemed a little bit less after doing the Mountain Lion upgrade, at least from what we were experiencing in Lion. A couple of other websites have confirmed that battery life improved, but maybe hasn't returned all the way to where it was under Lion. The Mac Observer actually did some pretty extensive battery life tests on a couple different units, a MacBook Pro, a Retina MacBook Pro, and a MacBook Air. And what they noticed was that there definitely was a loss in battery life in moving from Lion to Mountain Lion 10.8, and that 10.8.1 only slightly restored the battery life back. So by their estimates, what they were seeing is a 16 to 33% reduction in battery life over Lion in the upgrade to Mountain Lion, and that there was just a slight improvement when you updated to 10.8.1. With the Macs that they were testing, they did note that all of them were getting within, at least with the 10.8.1 update, within Apple's stated 5 to 7 hour battery life, although more along the lines of the 5 hour end instead of the 7 hour end. So your results may vary, but just some interesting things to note about battery life in Mountain Lion. Apple has already actually seeded new betas of Mountain Lion 10.8.2 to developers. They're asking developers to take a look at Messages, Facebook, Game Center, Safari, and Reminders. The release notes do state that there's no known issues, but they are asking developers to focus on those parts. So it looks like we may see a 10.8.2 update in the not-too-distant future. And yes, I will admit it. I did bury the lead this week. Many of you are probably wondering at this point why I haven't talked about the Apple versus Samsung verdict in their patent lawsuit case. The reason being is because I personally don't like lawsuit coverage very much. I think I've talked about this on the MacCast, but this one really is unavoidable. And it's because Apple was pretty much handed down a huge win in the case. I don't know if it could have gone much better for Apple. I guess a little bit better because they didn't win on every account, but pretty much they crushed Samsung in this one. They won on most of their claims of patent infringement for their utility patents, their design patents, and their trade dress, specifically on smartphones. Interestingly, Apple didn't win in its infringement case against the Samsung Galaxy Tab 10.1. So on the tablet front, they weren't so successful. But on the smartphone side, they did very well. Not all of the phones cited in the infringement were found to be infringing, but enough to strike a big blow to Samsung. Apple was actually awarded just over $1 billion in the settlement, and that figure, I guess, actually could go up. So the judge has the ability to raise that maybe up to triple the original amount. So it could end up somewhere in the $3 billion range. You know, as far as just my opinion and thoughts on this, I really hate these lawsuits. I get the laws and I understand Apple's right and duty to go after Samsung to protect their patents. And that's fine. It's just that when all is said and done, I'm not so sure that business or the consumers or competition actually ends up being better off at the end of all of this. Tim Cook came out and made a statement. He was pretty happy, I think, with the results, and I think rightfully so. He said, really, it's more about values and Apple. And, you know, he had come out and said statements to the effect that they didn't want Apple being the designer and innovator for the rest of the world. That, you know, they put out these products, they work very hard on them, and to just have companies like Samsung come in and seemingly rip off, or I guess now validated, steal their designs, that's something they don't want happening. They just want fairness and they want values to prevail, and they really felt in this case their win demonstrates that's what happened. And I think in a lot of ways, in this particular case, that may be correct. Samsung was pretty egregious in a lot of their copying and what they did and stuff like that. I don't know that they were necessarily more so than other companies, though. I think the thing for Apple, yes, it was about values, but I don't know if I buy that it was 100% about that. I think it was also about licensing and Apple needing to make sure that there was teeth added to their patents so that other companies thinking about trying to do what Samsung did and avoiding the licensing, you know, Apple, it came out in the trial, Apple had made licensing offers to Samsung. It had come out that Google has done licensing deals with Apple and had even told Samsung, we think your products are too closely copying Apple, you need to be careful. So I think Apple wants to prove that, yes, these patents have teeth, we can use them aggressively, and we can fight this stuff, and we can win. Of course, now there's going to be appeals. Apple's going to file injunctions trying to stop sales of Samsung devices. Samsung's going to appeal and fight it and continue to fight it. So this isn't the end of all of this. It's going to be ongoing, and that's another part of this that I really don't like. But I think ultimately where it's going to end up is Samsung's going to end up licensing some of this stuff from Apple so that they can move on, maybe for less money than Apple would totally get in the settlement. So I don't think it's about money. I think it's about principle. And I think Apple really firmly believes that. But I think the other problem is that this really perpetuates the bigger problem that we have with patent and IP technology and stuff like that. It's going to force and reinforce this sort of land grab that's going on now. These people just building up huge patent pools and trying to settle all this stuff in court. And I'm not convinced that that does a whole lot for competition and innovation. But Mike Elgin had a really great piece. He pointed out, you know, if you're going to be mad at anything, don't be mad at Apple. Don't be mad at Samsung for participating in this kind of circus and this thing that's going on. Be mad at this system that's been put in place. you know, Apple has to play this game because they're in ways forced to play this game. If they don't go after this stuff, if they don't protect their patents and their designs aggressively, then they can potentially get sued back by somebody who does. You know, there's a lot of similarities across these products in the industry. And if it's not going one way, it's the other. So it's sort of like this little patent IP cold war that's been set up. And that's what really frustrates me. So the system has become the problem. And that doesn't necessarily mean we have to like it, but we can at the same time understand it. Now, all that said and done, something that I really enjoyed watching and saw, and I think a lot of people should take a look at if you want to understand where I'm coming from on this, is Kirby Ferguson has a series of videos called Everything is a Remix. I think he even did a TED Talk on this, and it has to do with art and culture and design and products. I mean, it really spans the range of what we're talking about here. And that is that there really aren't any original ideas or new ideas. Everything is just a remix of everything else. And they give some really concrete examples, especially from TV and film, but also, you know, across product designs. And in his TED Talk, he talks about some of the Apple designs and things like that. You know, Apple has made a history in their own products, and this is why I feel like sometimes Apple comes off as a little bit hypocritical. They've made a history of copying and innovating based on the designs of others. You know, Xerox PARC had the ideas for the graphic user interface in the desktop. Steve Jobs took inspiration for round rectangles in the original Mac OS from street signs. This is documented lore in history. You know, he looked around and said, you know what, signs are all have these rounded corners. Why can't computers have rounded corners? So taking ideas and applying them in a different way and with different technologies and innovating. You look at the iPad and you can argue that sci-fi really designed and generated that product, that Star Trek had pads long before we had the iPad, and one sort of feeds on the other, and that's where inspiration and innovation comes from. But to say it's all original, if you really get down to it, is probably very disingenuous. But what's happening is we're starting to create rules and restrictions and really narrow the space where you can leverage and borrow ideas and move on concepts from the past. And you start to get, with all these legal battles, people are going to start to get gun shy. And I think that really restricts innovation. We're kind of closing up those opportunities to remix ideas and designs into new things. And I don't know if that's what we really want. It seems to me like it also ends up taking a lot of time, energy, money, resources that end up getting wasted and forced. There's a lot of time and energy put into these legal battles when we could be spending all that time and energy out innovating, even remixing, if you were, these great ideas into the next generations of ideas. So I just worry we're going to go too far down a path and get to the point where no one's going to even want to bother to try and innovate because somebody's going to say they borrowed or took the idea from somebody else's idea. And that just seems ultimately bad for history. So that's why I don't like to talk about this stuff, because it's going to be ongoing. And until the system itself changes, we're really going to continue to perpetuate and have these problems. But again, at the same time, I understand why Apple did what they needed to do, and I'm happy for their victory. I just don't know that, once again, we're better off as consumers. And if that you know, that's going to make Apple or Samsung or anybody have better products, especially if it starts to shut down competition. If people stop trying to compete with Apple because they feel there's no way that they can, or Apple has built up such a IP patent portfolio that there's just no edge into a market, then we just end up with monopolies, and that's not good for anybody. So we're going to watch it. I don't think that that's Apple's intent. I don't want to give the wrong idea here, but it is something that we need to take as kind of a cautionary thing and just watch and make sure that we don't fall into that trap, because it could happen. And then finally in the news for this week, it's looking like the fall's not going to be all about the iPhone and the iPad mini. There might be some new Macs in the mix as well, at least according to Richard Shim, an analyst at NPD Display Search. They claim that their supply chain checks show that Apple is in production or ramping up production of new 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro displays. The displays are reportedly being produced by all three Apple suppliers, LG, Samsung, and Sharp, and supposedly the initial orders are expected to exceed the initial numbers that Apple had ordered for the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro. That makes it look like Apple's really expecting pretty high demand of a 13-inch Retina MacBook. And the display itself is said to be 2560 by 1600 pixels, which is exactly double the resolution of the current models, which are at 1280 by 800. Speculation is that Apple would update that 13-inch MacBook Pro with new models sometime in the fall, likely in the September timeframe, possibly October, but it's sounding like toward the end of September. My guess is that with the two major announcements happening around the same time with the iPhone 5 and the rumored iPad mini announcement, that a 13-inch Mac Retina MacBook Pro update would kind of happen as almost like a soft launch silently. Apple might update the website, maybe put out a press release, but I don't think they're going to do any big event, and I don't expect it to be mentioned at either of the fall announcements for the other products. So if you've been waiting on that 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, waiting to make that new purchase, you may be doing that in the next few weeks. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show's sponsors, and that is Smile. They make a bunch of great products, but I'm just going to come out and say it right now. PDF Pen is awesome. Actually, all their products are awesome, but PDF Pen is particularly awesome, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. You know, if you're going paperless, I think it's almost a must-have application. You can use it to mark up and edit your PDFs. You can add annotations. You can insert images and signatures. Key for going paperless. I use it for signatures all the time. A MacCast listener, Jerry, actually bought PDF Pen and sent me an email to tell me he really liked that he discovered that, unlike Preview, it handles selecting columns of text in a multi-column document correctly. If you do it in Preview, you'll notice it just goes right across the columns. PDF Pen, it selects within the column like it should. And I remember when they added that feature a little while back. So great for that sort of thing. I've used it to convert client forms for my web clients. They want to put PDF forms up on their website, but they usually send me what we call a fake form, right? It looks like a form, but it doesn't have any form fields on it. So I can use PDF Pen, add the form fields to it, and really make it a true form. And there's PDF Pen for the iPad, which makes the whole package even cooler because you can get it to go. You can get it on your mobile device. Has a lot of the same features that you'd come to expect. I particularly like that it has iCloud integration and has that integration in OS X, including in Lion. They have an application you get through the Mac App Store or along with your purchase of PDF Pen for the Mac so that you can do the cloud integration. You can put your documents up into iCloud and access them from PDF Pen on the iPad wherever you go. You can add signatures to your documents on the go, which is great. You get an email in, hey, can you sign this? If you're out and about and you have your iPad, sure, I've got PDF Pen for my iPad. Away we go. And sign it and send it right back. It has the library in there so you can keep your signatures right inside the application. Makes them really easy to insert into your documents. And they have a free trial of the Mac version on their website. PDF Pen for iPad is just $14.99 on the App Store. So great price. And you can get all the information and more details over at smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So with the release of Mountain Lion, Apple has officially transitioned to selling upgrades to the operating system exclusively through the App Store, exclusively through digital download. There is no retail boxed copy. They don't have the little USB stick like you could get with Mountain Lion or with Lion, excuse me. And Greg sent me an email wondering, you know, now that it's sold exclusively through the App Store, what happens when I go to resell my Mac? If it came pre-installed with Lion and I upgraded to Mountain Lion, what exactly is going to happen? What operating system do I put on there? How do I put the operating system on there and turn around and sell it? And from the research that I was able to do, it seems like Apple's policy on the operating system and transferring the license is pretty clear. What they say is that the OS that came with a Mac is essentially licensed to that Mac. And that any operating system that was purchased as an update on the Mac App Store or an upgrade is licensed to the individual, and more specifically in the case of the App Store, with your Apple ID. So the deal is if you bought a Mac and it came pre-installed with Mountain Lion, then that Mountain Lion license would transfer with the Mac. You could wipe the drive, reinstall Mountain Lion, and that is not tied to any Apple ID. You can boot from the recovery volume and reinstall it. You can even boot to internet recovery, and supposedly it'll download a copy of Mountain Lion because that's what came with the machine and won't require any authentication, or it's not attached to an Apple ID. Same thing goes along with Lion. If you bought your machine with Lion, you can reinstall Lion, sell it, and that will transfer to the new owner. Now, if you bought a machine and it came pre-installed with Lion and then you upgraded to Mountain Lion, or say you upgraded from Snow Leopard to Mountain Lion, that upgrade is actually attached to your Apple ID, to your account, so you are the owner of that. You can take that, install it onto a new system that you might purchase, but you cannot take that and transfer it to the other owner. As a matter of fact, because of the App Store licensing and you have license for multiple Macs within a household, I would assume you could also take that license. Well, I know you can take that license and transfer it to your other Macs that you own, but you cannot transfer that when you sell the Mac. What you'd have to do is reinstall Lion back onto it, or if it was a machine that originally came with Snow Leopard, you'd have to boot from the original Snow Leopard disks, reinstall that, and put that on it when you sell it to the new owner. So, hard and fast rule, whatever came pre-installed on the Mac is licensed to be transferred when you sell it. Anything that you purchased after the fact is actually licensed to you, and they're pretty cut and dry on that one. So, if you do want to sell your machine and you want to make sure that the new owner gets the latest version of the operating system, something you could do that would be really cool would be knock $20 off the price of Mountain Lion in the Mac App Store, and just tell them go ahead and purchase it on your own. Or you could even throw in like an Apple Store gift card, $20 Apple Store gift card, and say, here, you can use this to buy the upgrade to Mountain Lion. Now, iLife gets a little bit trickier. A lot of people are going to wonder, well, what about the bundled version of iLife that came with my Mac? And when you buy a new Mac, as far as I understand it, that software is licensed to an Apple ID. It's, again, licensed to the user because you register the Mac, you sign up for the Mac App Store with your Apple ID, and that's how you re-download the software if you need to reinstall it. Even though it's pre-installed, I think it becomes, at that point, locked to your Apple ID. So that's, again, licensed to you, not to the machine. So in that case, that would not transfer. So once again, if you wanted to be really cool, you could give someone an Apple iTunes gift card to repurchase that stuff through, or excuse me, App Store gift card to repurchase that stuff through the App Store. But barring that, it doesn't, as far as I know, it doesn't transfer. You might be able to call up Apple and get them to transfer the license to another ID, but that might be a little bit of a tricky process and you might have to work at that. So that's my understanding, Greg, of how it all works. If somebody knows something different or if I got anything wrong in that, but all of my research seemed to show that that's how it would go. Brian sent me an interesting email. He had a little bit of a dilemma. He was playing around on his Mac trying to recover some disk space, and he was checking his disk usage in a couple of different applications. The Finders Get Info window, he was using Disk Utility, he was using some third-party apps like Daisy Disk, which is one of these great utilities that shows you where all the large files are on your system. I think we've talked about Grand Perspective, which is an open source one that I use, but Daisy Disk is one that has a really nice UI to it. I actually got a copy of that through one of those bundled software things and have used it for a couple years. But he was looking at all this stuff and noticed that there was a discrepancy specifically between what Disk Utility was reporting for used space on his drive versus what the Finders Get Info window was reporting for used space. In his case, he noticed that Disk Utility was saying he was using about 126 gigs of space, but the Finders Get Info window claimed he was only using 70 gigabytes. So that was a pretty big discrepancy. He was going like, why does Disk Utility think that I have that I'm using almost 56 more gigabytes of storage than the Finder does? And the answer turned out to be because he was actually using 56 more gigabytes and just didn't know it. And you're thinking, well, how could that be possible? I would know if I was using almost 60 gigs of space somewhere on my system. And the reality is it wasn't actually Brian who was using up that space. It was actually Time Machine, and more correctly, a feature of Time Machine that was added in macOS 10 Lion that was actually eating up the extra disk space, or just borrowing it, really, when we get into the nitty-gritty. And what it is a feature called Time Machine Local Snapshots. It was added in Lion, and it really only comes into play on portables and only if you are using Time Machine. So what happens is local snapshots, when you have Time Machine enabled, when your machine is disconnected from the external Time Machine drive, it will actually use space on the internal volume to create backups and snapshots on its regular schedule. So every hour or so, it's going to back up any changed files, but it's going to do that to a special area on the internal hard drive. It's actually created in the root volumes folder in a folder called mobile backups. So /volumes/mobile backups for those of you who are familiar with the Unix paths. And it will only create those volumes or create that backup if there's at least 20% free disk space left on your internal drive. And if your disk gets to the point where it's 80% full or more, what'll happen is Time Machine will actually start deleting some of the oldest local snapshots so that it can make room to create others. Local snapshots are also reduced once per day after 24 hours and reduced down to just the single one-day backups, and then also deleted after a week. So there should be no local snapshot backups that are older than a week old. And when you enter Time Machine, you can actually identify those local snapshots because you'll see little tick marks in the timeline. And if they're gray, those are local snapshots. If they're pink, those are the snapshots that are on your external volume, your traditional Time Machine backup. So if you want to see if you have local snapshots and how much data they might be eating up, the easiest way to tell if local snapshots are being saved is open up the Time Machine preferences, go into System Preferences Time Machine, and you'll see in Lion that there in the text, it'll say Time Machine keeps local backups as space permits. And if you have that text there, you know that it'll create these local backups if you're disconnected. Actually, just if you have Time Machine turned on and you're running Lion, and it will be creating these backups by default. You really can't turn it off from the graphic user interface. And if you want to see how much storage those backups are actually using, or if they're using any storage at all, you can use the storage display, which is part of the system information panel. So if you go to the Apple menu, choose About This Mac, and then when the dialog comes up, click the More Info button, and then go to the Storage tab. You can see all of your hard drives there. Find your main hard drive, your boot hard drive, and then look for the backups value. It'll be listed in the little bar graph that's there. You should be able to see a visual representation of what space it's taking up, as well as the actual amount listed there. And remember, this is only on notebooks. So if you have a desktop Mac, you're not going to see this. You can also check the comparison of the available space from the Finder's Git Info window versus what you might see in Disk Utility. Again, this is how Brian discovered it. The Finder's Git Info window ignores the backup data that is used by Time Machine local snapshots. And the reason for that is because in the Finder's mind, that space is always still available. If your drive is getting full, it's going to go ahead and purge that information. So it's really not used up space. Disk Utility knows that that storage is being used, so it reports the value as being larger. Now, if you really don't like the idea of Time Machine kind of creating these local backups when you have a disconnected, when you've disconnected from your Time Machine disk, then you have a couple options. One simple one, without it having to do any terminal hacking, is to simply make sure that when you disconnect from your Time Machine drive, you also go into the system preferences and just turn off Time Machine backups. Problem there is when you get back home and you're reconnected to your drive, you're going to need to remember to turn that back on. I actually got myself into trouble like this one time because I didn't realize I hadn't re-enabled my Time Machine backups and I lost some data. So that can be a little bit risky. The other way you can go about this is there actually is a terminal command that you can issue to disable the local Time Machine backups. I'll have the commands in the show notes at maccast.com. I don't want to get into them right now because it gets kind of technical, but you can turn them off and there's a command for turning them back on. Interestingly, you can also force a local snapshot with a little terminal command. So if you want to force it creating a local snapshot, even when you're connected to your external Time Machine drive, you can do that as well. And once you've disabled this feature, you can tell that it's off by going into the Time Machine Preferences pane. And remember that text I was telling you about earlier that said Time Machine keeps local backups as space permits? That will no longer appear in the Time Machine Preferences pane. So you'll know that it's disabled once you've run that terminal command if you don't see that any longer. Now, all of this said, interestingly, in Brian's case, you know, I mentioned that you have to have Time Machine turned on and you have to be running Lion or Mountain Lion to have these local snapshots created. Brian says that he never enabled Time Machine on his Mac, and yet he still had these local storage files. So he thinks it might be a bug that was introduced in the 10.8.1 update because he didn't notice it till after running 10.8.1. And that possibly 10.8.1 is creating these local storage files, even if you don't have Time Machine enabled. I went and checked this on my MacBook Air that I had upgraded to Mountain Lion, and I did run the 10.8.1 update. I did not see any of these local backups being stored on my system. So I don't know what's going on there. I don't know if it's only specific models that are maybe having the issue. If you've run into this, let us know. If you've seen similar behavior to what Brian has seen, I just haven't seen enough information to indicate that there is a bug, but there could be one, and that's why I'm kind of bringing this up. And plus, it was also a great opportunity to learn a little bit about these local snapshots, which I hadn't delved into. I knew Apple was doing them. I didn't know technically where they were stored or how they worked and stuff like that. So thanks, Brian, for sending in your comment and your question, and I think we all learned something. I think it was on the last MacCast where we had a question from a listener about setting up a home media server. I think specifically we were talking about an iTunes server, something for music where you could centralize all your music onto a single device. I think in his particular case, he was looking at network-attached storage devices. I think I had recommended setting up a old Mac with iTunes, maybe using some of the home sharing features and stuff like that to share everything on your local area network. Well, I received a follow-up comment from Ron, and he had some great recommendations and ideas if you want to take those concepts and sort of extend them outside the area of your local area network. Here's what Ron had to say.
Hey, Adam, my name's Ron. I'm just calling in reference to the one caller who had asked about sharing content across multiple devices. And I noticed that your suggestion of, you know, using home sharing is definitely an excellent option that way. And I'm using my MacBook Pro at home to do the same thing. My end goal eventually is to transition all my content sharing and home sharing through a Mac Mini server setup situation. When I got my iPad recently, I went with the 16 gig model for that very reason, because I realized I could store all my content when I was in my house on the server. But then I realized that when I left the house, unless I synced that information before I left, I couldn't take that content with me. The one thing I did, though, after some research, is I found out that there's actually several really decent apps in the App Store, and maybe some listeners would be interested in learning about some of these, that do allow you to actually connect back to your house. There may be some setup required that allows you to still access that content either from an iPhone or an iPad device, you know, if you have a cellular connection or even a Wi-Fi connection. For movies and stuff, I picked up a app in the App Store. I think it's about $2 called Air Video. That allows me to pull down through any videos that are on my Mac if I set up the folder set up through those. It doesn't do DRM-protected content. But the other really big thing that I thought was kind of cool is there's one called Blink, B-L-I-N-Q, that's in there that's a free app that actually you can set up to broadcast certain picture folders as well as your iPhoto library onto your device without actually storing your iPhoto library onto the device that way. And finally, for audio, if I ever forget a song to sync, I mean, you could always use iTunes Match to download that stuff to a $25 a year, but there's one called Audio Galaxy, which is also a free app download that allows you to go through and search for content on your Mac that way. All these apps obviously require your Mac to be turned on to work and are also very dependent on your internet connection on both lines. But for me, that's worked really well, and I figured I'd just kind of share that in case that helps any other the listeners, you know, with that situation, in case that turned up. So great show, and look forward to hearing more what you contribute.
Hey, thanks, Ron. I really appreciate the contribution because that is a great point. You know, you can get all this stuff on your server, but when you're out and about, especially with your iOS devices, with your mobile devices, you might want to have access to that, and you may not have remembered to sync everything over or sync stuff up. So it's nice to know that we have these options. I particularly am a big fan of Air Video. I don't know if I've talked about it on the MacCast in the past. I know we've brought it up on several occasions on the We Have Communicators podcast. And that's because it's really a great app. You install it on your Mac. It's a little kind of server that sits there. And one of my favorite features is that it does on-the-fly video format conversions. So you don't even have to make sure that you remember to encode your video files into a format that's supported on your iOS devices, because the software can actually convert that on the fly as in real time as it's streaming it out to your device, which is just, it just blows my mind that we have that kind of computing power in our Macs, but we really do. So that's cool. I've not checked out Blink Photo. I'm going to definitely check that out. And the Audio Galaxy thing I'd heard about before too, and I've heard that's a pretty good service. I have iTunes Music Match, so I haven't found that I personally have a need for that, but great suggestions, and I'll have a links to all of these in the show notes at maccast.com in case you missed any of them. I do want to point out that all of these services, generally what they require is that you install a little application on your Mac that runs in the background that acts kind of as the server for this content. So each one of these little servers is going to dip into either specific folders or specific areas of content. I guess in the case of Blink Photo, something like your iPhoto library, to actually grab the content that it's going to serve up and serve out. And most of them are going direct from your Mac to your device. So there's not a server component where your photos are going to be uploaded to a server or your music is going to be uploaded to a server. Some of them offer those options. So you need to make sure that you understand how the service works if you're concerned about privacy and security. But a lot of them, what the little application you install does is mainly act as a directory service. So your application will ping, say, Blink Photo servers or Audio Galaxy's servers just to get the IP address, the address to know how to connect back to your home system. And that's why a lot of them don't require you to do a lot of fancy firewall configuration. You don't have to worry about getting a static IP address or those sorts of things. That's kind of handled by the handshake of the software, and that's why you need the little client applications. But beyond that, pretty much at that point, the servers are going to make a direct connection from device to Mac, and that's actually a good way to go from a security standpoint. But again, check with each one of the individual applications and really understand how it works. And like I said, a lot of them do have the features to actually upload your content into the cloud. So if you don't want that going on, you want to probably make sure that you don't turn on those features or that they're not on by default. And that's my only caveat when you're looking into this stuff. And again, know the companies that it's coming from. But these three, I've used at least one of them, and it looks like the other ones are pretty legitimate. They have pretty good reviews and stuff like that. So thanks, Ron, for sending in the suggestion. I'm also going to give a really strong second recommendation to Apple's iTunes Music Match service. You know, I was a little hesitant about it at first. I wasn't sure how it was going to work. I absolutely love it. For $25 a year, the features and functionality that it brings, the ability for me to connect it to all of my iOS devices and all of my Macs has been fabulous. I don't have to worry about where my music is. It's all up on Apple's music service. And because a lot of that stuff's already in the iTunes store, most of it didn't have to get uploaded. I have a lot of content that I ripped myself that just matched and now I have access to it. I actually have access to better quality versions of it, because when I ripped it way back when, we didn't even have options for it. Like, I would have never even considered doing a 256 kilobit per second encode of that stuff, because it would have just been too big of a file for the storage and stuff that we had at that point. So it is a great service, and I think is well worth the $25 a year. And I know it's not rolled out into every country yet. If it comes to your country, seriously consider looking into it, especially if you have a lot of your content in iTunes. I think it just makes it so convenient. So there you go. And again, thanks, Ron, for bringing up the fact that, you know, we do more and more these days want to be able to access this content remotely. And then finally for today, I've got a little trick that I learned, and I actually covered on MacCast member episode 61 in a lot of detail, but I want to recap it here because it came up. Somebody was asking me about the reliability of home wireless connection, Wi-Fi connection. They have a number of devices that they connect to their home network, and had remembered that I talked a little bit about using something called DHCP reservations as a way to kind of increase and improve the reliability of your wireless connections, or the connections for your wireless devices on your home network, and specifically related to when devices go to sleep and wake back up. You know, you can sometimes have issues where they end up with conflicting IP addresses, and when that's on your network, that can cause kind of problems. And so your router at home in most cases is set up to provide dynamic IP addresses to the various Macs and devices that connect to it. So when you connect to your Wi-Fi, it gives your machine a temporary address, or your device a temporary address that it can use on the network. And when the device goes away, say it goes to sleep, it puts that address back into a pool that it has, and when another device comes on, it can give out that address. Well, in some cases, you might have situations where a device that went off the network or went to sleep kind of holds on to that information, and maybe then the router gave out that address to a different device. The original one comes back online with the same address. That creates a conflict and creates some network issues. So to avoid that, one of the things that I discovered and started to use was something called DHCP reservations. And this is something that's supported in your Macs and your iOS devices. It's configurable in an airport base station. And also, if you have a third-party router, a lot of those support this feature as well. And in essence, what it does is it allows you to say, okay, here's a machine I'm going to tell you about. Anytime you see this machine, give them this specific address. Basically, reserve that IP address for a specific machine. Hold it out of the pool and don't give it out unless it's going to a specific model. It's a little bit different than just statically IP addressing your machines, but somewhat similar, right? But it's still coming out of that same sort of DHCP pool that your router has. So in order to set this up, the first thing you need to do is you need to know an identifier for the device or the Mac. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. You can set up what's called a DHCP client ID, or you can get the Mac address of the specific device, which is the hardware address for its network interface, either its Ethernet interface or its airport Wi-Fi interface. And the way you do that is on the Mac, you can assign a DHCP client ID by going into System Preferences, going under Network, selecting the interface that you want to assign a client ID to, either Ethernet or Airport, and then click the Advanced button in the settings. And then from there, go to the TCP/IP tab where you can set up the DHCP settings, and you'll notice a box there that says DHCP client ID, and I think it might even say optional. In there, you can type in an ID for whatever you want that device to be called on your network or recognized as by DHCP on your network, and you'll need to remember that for later because that's the ID we're going to take and plug into your router settings. So that's how you set it up on a Mac. On iOS, it's somewhat similar. You go into Settings, into General, into Network. You select the network interface that you want to assign the DHCP ID to. Click the little blue icon on the network interface to go into its settings. and you'll notice a place to set the DHCP client ID under the DHCP settings. Again, type in whatever you want, remember what that is, and we're going to use that later when we go and set up the reservations in your router. If you'd prefer to use the MAC address, that's the media access control address for the interface. There, the way you access that on the Mac is you go into your system preferences, go into network, select the interface, click the advanced button, and then go to the hardware tab. And under there, you'll see the MAC address, which is this long address separated by colons. It's a bunch of two-digit letters and numbers separated by colons. I think there's, I can't remember how many quote-unquote octets or little sets of those there are, but it's a somewhat long number. Just copy that, remember it, and that's where what we're going to plug into the router settings. You can also find it in the system profiler under the network locations area. And again, look for MAC address and find the value there. In iOS, it's in settings, general, under about, and then you're going to look for what they call Wi-Fi address on your iOS device, and that's going to be the MAC address for that. Now, once you have that information, you've either assigned the DHCP client ID or you have the MAC address for the device you want to create the reservation for. Actually, making the reservation is pretty straightforward. Open up Airport Utility, and I'm going to tell you how to do it from the newest version of Airport Utility. If you have an older version of the Airport Utility, it's somewhat similar. But in the latest version, go ahead and select your airport base station, click the Edit button, and then go to the Network tab, and you want to locate the DHCP Reservations section. There, you'll click the little plus button to add a new reservation. In the description, you can type anything you want. So you might say, you know, my iPad or my iPhone. And then in the Reserve By option, you're going to either pick MAC address or DHCP client ID. I like to use the DHCP client ID because then I could name each one of my devices and it kind of helps me remember what it is. The MAC address is a little bit cryptic. I don't necessarily remember, you know, which MAC address went with which device. So I find the ID a little bit more user-friendly. But go ahead and then plug in the MAC address or the client ID. You'll enter then the IP address that you want to reserve or assign to that device. It'll actually auto-pick the next available IP address in the DHCP range. So if you want to just accept the default, but you can also override it. And then go ahead and click Done to update your airport. And you'll have to reset your airport base station to get the changes to take effect. But once you've done that, that device that you've set it up for, when it connects to your router, should be assigned the IP address that you reserved for it. You may, in some cases, have to reset the device or disconnect it from the Wi-Fi and reconnect it or reset the DHCP lease, but once you've done that and connected, you should be able to go into its network settings and confirm that it has the reserved IP address, and it should always have that IP address from that point forward every time it connects to your base station. And that will help, I think, a little bit with the reliability, especially when you have devices coming on and off your network. And give that a try. I thought it was a cool feature, and I've used it on all my devices. And you know, I don't have hard evidence for it, but in general, I think my reliability's improved, and that's all that really matters, right? If I think it's better, it is better. But give that a try, and I think it can help out in certain scenarios. So, with that, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, and now iTrash. Check it out. Fun little application. You can get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, PDF Pen for iPad, and Text Expander Touch. You can get more information on all their software as well as trials of their Mac apps over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle, great place to get cash for your old iOS devices, your old Macs. And actually right now they're locking in prices for iPhone 4S's. So those of you who are considering upgrading to an iPhone 5, you might want to go check out the site right now, gazelle.com, see what kind of offers they're offering up. And I think you even get to keep your device until the new device comes out, so you don't even have to send it in, but you can sort of lock in your buyback rate over at gazelle.com. So big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. If you have a question, a comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. Be sure to check out the website. There you'll find show notes with links to everything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, check out the forum. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/MacCast or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That'll do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.